Biden and Trump meet at the White House.
Do everything we can to make sure you're accommodated, what you need. We're going to get a chance to talk about some of that today. So good. Welcome.
Kyiv attacked by Russian missiles.
It was the first time Russia had fired ballistic missiles at Ukraine's capital since August.
And a look at Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense.
He was a very unexpected pick. To be honest, I was talking to several people, and you know, they had expected a more traditional Republican heavy hitter.
Today is Thursday, November 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. We begin the show in the U.S. President-elect Donald Trump returned to Washington on Wednesday. He visited both Congress and the White House and outlined his vision as he readies for his second term. President Joe Biden hosted Trump in the Oval Office, where he promised a smooth transfer of power. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
Donald Trump said he would return. And on Wednesday, here he was, back in his old stomping grounds as president-elect. He and President Joe Biden had this lightning-quick exchange in the Oval Office.
Do everything we can to make sure you're accommodated, what you need. And we're going to get a chance to talk about some of that today. So
good.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much. And politics is tough. And it's, in many cases, not a very nice world. But it is a nice world today. And I appreciate it very much. And a transition that's so smooth, it'll be as smooth as it can get, and I very much appreciate that, Jim.
Earlier Wednesday, Trump visited Congress, where he was welcomed by House Speaker Mike Johnson.
They used to call Bill Clinton the comeback kid. This is the comeback king. He is the king, okay?
Trump has moved fast since his election victory in announcing who he wants to carry out his policies. Notable on that list is South African investor and billionaire Elon Musk. Trump has named him and former Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy to co-lead an entity aimed at cutting federal spending. Historians say the recent happenings in American politics are significant. Jeremy Suri is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
It's also significant because when he left office, as you said, he left under a cloud of controversy, and his election now shows that for the majority of American voters, they wanted him back. And so it is in some ways a reawakening for his movement and for what he represents.
Trump will be back in Washington to take his oath of office on January 20th. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
And there is a potential transfer of power in Germany as well. Chancellor Olaf Scholz is under pressure to call a confidence vote after the recent collapse of his governing coalition. The move would likely usher in new elections in the coming weeks. It comes, though, at a critical time for Europe as the continent prepares for a Trump presidency in the United States. Trump has suggested he may cut U.S. support for Ukraine. With Germany among Europe's biggest military donors to Kyiv, how its elections would affect Europe's support for Ukraine remains to be seen. VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports.
Germans will head to the polls on February 23rd, following the collapse of the three-party coalition government last week. Chancellor Olaf Scholz has said he will stand again as the Social Democrats' candidate. But the main opposition, Christian Democrats, have a big lead in the polls. Their leader, Friedrich Merz, argued for a quicker election.
Let me just remind everyone that we do not have a federal budget for 2025.
The three-party ruling coalition collapsed following disagreements over raising new debt to finance the 2025 budget, including the provision of military aid to Ukraine. Berlin is the second biggest donor of military aid to Kyiv after the United States, giving around $11 billion worth since Russia's February 2022 invasion. The outgoing government had planned to cut that aid to just over $4 billion next year. Mattia Nellis is the founder of the German-Ukraine Bureau, a political consultancy based in Düsseldorf.
It's bad timing for Ukraine, bad timing for Europe. It means Germany will be preoccupied with itself for a few months before we have a new government.
The election is set to take place just weeks after the inauguration of Donald Trump as the next U.S. president. Again, Mattia Nellis.
the worst case that many fear in Berlin and Kyiv, an incoming Trump administration taking power in January, then slashing or ending the Ukraine aid will force the German government, the lame duck Scholz government, with the current parliament to increase the funding for Ukraine.
Also not clear is what the incoming Trump presidency could mean for wider European security, including the deployment of US forces and equipment, such as long-range Tomahawk missile systems, says analyst Marina Miron, a defence analyst at King's College London.
What else might be reversed is the placement of Tomahawks in Germany. So we have quite a situation where, let's say, Trump might pursue an anti-globalist agenda and push NATO countries to invest more of their GDP into defense.
Europe froze about $200 billion of Russian assets following Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. The interest is being used to help fund weapons for Kyiv. Some argue it's time to seize the assets entirely. Again, Mattia Nellis of the German-Ukrainian Bureau.
Europe is sitting on a war chest of $200 billion of frozen Russian assets, and I think the incoming Trump administration will push the Europeans to go further. And that's welcome news from the Ukrainian side, to not just give loans and credits based on frozen Russian assets, but to move to confiscate the assets themselves. And that's certainly something many in Germany also support.
Chancellor Scholz oversaw German efforts to end reliance on cheap Russian energy. But analysts say that has driven inflation and undermined confidence in Europe's biggest economy. At the same time, analysts say Germany is struggling to overcome decades of underinvestment in its armed forces, something the next government will have to address. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Elsewhere in Europe, in the early hours Wednesday, Russian forces launched ballistic and cruise missiles on Kyiv. It was the first time Russia fired missiles on the Ukrainian capital since August. For VOA, Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
Wednesday morning, Russian forces launched a combined attack on Kyiv. The attack included ballistic and cruise missiles, as well as drones. Kyiv authorities reported that Russian forces used North Korean ballistic missiles, air-launched cruise missiles, Iskander-M ballistic missiles, and drones. It was the first time Russia had fired ballistic missiles at Ukraine's capital since August. Kyiv citizens woke up to powerful explosions, which turned out to be the sound of air defense shutting down the missiles. Thousands of Kyiv citizens took shelter in the nearby metro stations until the attack was over. A Kyiv citizen, Yulia, is a mother of two. She described the missile attack as horrible. She said the Ukrainians have gotten used to the drone strikes to the extent one can get used to that, because this is what people in Kyiv particularly have been experiencing every night for the past months. The air alert sounded in the capital in the early hours of Wednesday. At this time, the cruise missiles were heading in the direction of the Kyiv region. When cruise missiles entered the airspace of Kyiv, Russian forces simultaneously launched a ballistic attack on the capital and finalized it with more drones. No casualties or damage were reported in Kyiv. However, one person was injured and a private house was damaged outside the city as a result of the attack. With winter approaching, Ukrainians expect more such attacks targeting energy infrastructure, as Russia is expected to consider energy as a wintertime weapon once again. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
On Wednesday's program, we learned about Florida Representative Mike Waltz, Trump's choice for national security advisor. Katerina Lisanova of VOA's Ukrainian service caught up with Waltz in the halls of the Capitol and asked him about his thoughts regarding the war in Ukraine.
What would be your policy or vision on Ukraine?
Oh, that's not up to me. That's up to the president.
But what are the possibilities, like, for example, to pressure Russia for their aggression?
Well, the president's been clear in terms of getting both sides of the table, and he's focused on ending the war and not perpetuating it.
That's incoming National Security Advisor and Republican Congressman Mike Waltz speaking with Katerina Lisanova of VOA's Ukrainian service.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
U.S. and Polish officials have opened a new NATO missile defense base in northern Poland. It was originally conceived years ago as a way to protect Europe from ballistic threats from Iran, but Poland has always seen it as a guarantee of U.S. protection in case of Russian aggression. The Kremlin has denounced the move.
Pakistan introduced more than 200 mobile clinics and added more beds and hospitals to treat nearly 70,000 patients daily with respiratory-related diseases as hazardous smog continued to cover the country's east. Punjab, Pakistan's most populous province, has been hit by a record-high wave of pollution since October. A spokesperson for the Punjab provincial government said Wednesday more than 2.1 million patients affected by smog have so far been treated.
A tribunal in Argentina has upheld a 6-year sentence and lifetime ban from upholding public office against former president Cristina Fernandez. Fernandez was convicted and sentenced in 2022 for a fraud scheme that embezzled millions of dollars through public works projects during her presidency. She can appeal to the Supreme Court, meaning that she'll remain free.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Returning now to Washington and Donald Trump's upcoming administration. The president-elect continues to fill his top cabinet position. Pete Hegseth, a former soldier and journalist, was an unlikely pick for Secretary of Defense. For a closer look, I spoke with VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb.
What do we know about Hegseth and his own opinions, his own beliefs? What has he said publicly before?
Well, he has shared a lot of his opinions on Fox News or when he's gone on podcasts and the like. He was a very unexpected pick, to be honest. I was talking to several people, and you know, they had expected a more traditional Republican heavy hitter in the House or the Senate, someone like Mike Rogers, who is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, or Tom Cotton, Joni Ernst, both on the Senate Armed Services Committee. So people that I've been speaking with today were surprised, but one former Pentagon official who I spoke to was actually praising him for his dedication to American troops and veterans. They said that you can guarantee that he will fight for the troops because he really cares. They pointed out that he has been the executive director for Concerned Veterans for America, which is a group that advocated for a greater privatization of the Department of Veterans Affairs to try to get at some of the logs that had been, you know, really burdening a lot of the veterans communities when they couldn't get the health care that they needed. So, you know, we're hearing a lot of reaction to this, but we're going to see in the coming weeks how this shakes out, because there is a question of will he get Senate confirmation. And it takes a majority that the Republicans have at this point. But if there are some that are concerned about his inexperience in government or in running a large business, both of which would be a huge help to run the Pentagon, which is, you know, a massive government agency, that will be something that we will see flesh out. I'm sure those are going to be the types of concerns being raised on the other side of, you know, by the Democrats, if not by some Republicans as well.
One of the things that Hegseth has said is that he is opposed to what are called DEI programs, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And he's said he wants to do away with as many of them as he can in the armed services. Will that go over well at the Pentagon?
Well, he has called diversity, equity, and inclusion programs woke. That's how he refers to them. He has publicly questioned the role of women in combat. I have been covering the Pentagon for 10 years. All of those combat positions were opened up to women by Secretary of Defense Ash Carter back in January of 2016. And since then, women have earned positions as Green Berets, Army Rangers, Navy combat craft crewmen, and they've all been competing and completing the same grueling task as the men. So that will be an interesting change if he tries to reverse that. He has also blamed some of the top generals and admirals for this diversity, equity, and inclusion. He's written in a book that there was kind of an attack on the warrior, and he called the book The War on Warriors. And basically it was pointing out that diversity, equity, and inclusion are prohibiting some of the recruits, because, you know, he would point out that there's a small percentage of the American public that are benefiting from these diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, in his opinion. And at the same time, the ads and the methods used to cater to that side of the population was turning off some of, in his, you know, in his words, he said, the young patriotic Christian men who traditionally fill the ranks.
What is it about Hegseth that that Trump liked? Why was he given the nomination?
Well, he has really devoted a lot of his time on air to standing up for the military service member and veterans. He himself is a combat veteran. He served tours of duty in Iraq, Afghanistan. He also served in Guantanamo Bay. And so he has pushed to make the U.S. military more lethal. And he has been a long-standing supporter of Trump. And Trump is very interested in putting people who are aligned with him in office this time.
VOA's Chief Pentagon Correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, thanks for your reporting on this.
Thanks for having me.
And in the Middle East, the lion's share of media attention has been on Gaza and more recently Lebanon, as Hamas and Hezbollah each fight with Israel. However, the fighting, the devastation and heartbreak, as well as the clampdown by Israeli authorities, have had a dramatic impact on the West Bank as well. Palestinians in the West Bank are also suffering. They are unable to work in jobs in Israel, and the entire economy of the West Bank is shrinking. Linda Granstein reports from the West Bank town of Ramallah.
Before the Hamas terror attack of October 7th, more than 200,000 Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza worked in Israel and supported the Palestinian economy. For more than a year, Israel has prohibited them from entering Israel, and they have all lost their jobs, mostly in construction. Shukia Najjar, a Palestinian house painter from Gaza, was working in the southern Israeli city of Be'er Sheva when the war began. Now he is unemployed and stuck in the West Bank Palestinian town of Ramallah, unable to enter Israel or to return to Gaza because the borders are closed.
Before the war, I was comfortable. Even when I was unemployed, I was with my family. There was no fear. Now the economy is worse, and I am very scared for my family's well-being, their safety.
Along with 80% of Gaza's residential buildings, Anajar says his family's home in northern Gaza was destroyed in an Israeli airstrike. Fortunately, he says, his family was not at home. The economy in Gaza has been destroyed, and UN agencies say it will take decades to rebuild. The economy in the Palestinian West Bank has also suffered significantly during a year of war, with unemployment rising to about 40%. Nasser Abdul Karim is a professor of economics at the Arab American University near Ramallah.
Here we lost around 10 to 12% of our GDP in West Bank after a year of the war. And now the unemployment rate tripled. And poverty, of course, will rise. So now we're talking about poverty in the West Bank of around 45%.
Many of the businesses in the West Bank are boarded up or operating at a severely reduced capacity. Palestinian blacksmith Rabbi Fleifel says he hardly earns enough to feed his children. His business, making iron grills and window decorations, is down by 90% because he says people are conserving their money for bare necessities. Similar sentiments are voiced across the street by Khalil Abu Arayes, the owner of an auto repair business.
People are not working. If they have 100 shekels, they want to save it to buy food. They don't want to come to an industrial area to buy a door or fix a car.
Many Palestinians in the West Bank say the current economic situation in the West Bank is the most difficult they've ever faced. They hope that the war in Gaza will end soon so they can resume working in Israel, which would allow the economy to begin to recover. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Ramallah in the West Bank.
Besides their daily jobs and families, some women from Ukraine's Kyiv region volunteer in a military unit to learn how to protect their country. Lysia Bakalets introduces us.
The world of numbers and codes is Inna's daily job. She is a mathematics and computer science teacher in a school in the Kyiv region. But it's not her only job. Every 3 days, Inna volunteers in a local military unit. She puts on her uniform inside the car. Inna asks that we not use her last name.
There's simply no time to go home. Armor is issued in the military unit.
Ina joined the volunteer unit when school summer vacation started. She volunteered as a civilian when Russia invaded Ukraine, but always felt she could do more.
I saw an advertisement that women volunteers were needed. I was hesitant about age. I'm 51, but decided to try. I have three children and want to protect them.
Colonel Andriy Verlaty came up with the idea to start a women's volunteer unit.
Until April 1st, my unit mainly consisted of men. But then the order to increase mobilization measures was issued, and my soldiers voluntarily joined different divisions of the armed forces.
Colonel Verlaty explains only those who cannot serve in regular service may join the volunteer formation. Demobilized and retired military, those who don't meet the conscription age, and women.
На 1 вересня було 93 жінки.
On September 1, from 120 of the total number of volunteers, 94 were women. Women do everything to be the best. They are more responsible and have a strong motivation.
Women patrol the city with the police and work as guards of honor. They all train to work in mobile air defense units too.
We are practicing now. The commander monitors the Russian drone on the tablet. We go to the point, mark drone coordinates, install machine guns, and meet the target.
All women are from the part of the Kyiv region that was occupied at the beginning of the war. In civilian life, Alina is an entrepreneur. Her colleague, with a call sign Lilo, is a barista.
I was in Bucha from the beginning of the occupation until March 11. My friends died under occupation.
Ina also recalls leaving the city with her children and says she doesn't want to feel that helpless again.
I can already hold a weapon, even with one hand. The physical form has become better. We mustn't let the Russians into the Kyiv region again. I don't want to use weapons, but I have to be ready.
Ina continues to combine both her military work and teaching. The school also lacks teachers. Her family was initially shocked by her decision. Now they say they are proud and look forward to her coming home after her daily shifts. Lesia Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally, today in northeastern Nigeria, conflict, inflation, and climate disasters have left millions struggling to survive. Reuters' Alice Rizzo has the story.
Having fled violence multiple times in Nigeria's rural Borno state, Indu Usman was trying to rebuild her life. She had turned to rearing cattle in the state capital, Maiduguri, for the town's annual Muslim holy days. Then, a flood swept everything away. Now she, her husband, and their six children live in an unfinished housing project turned into a displacement camp and are relying on handouts for food.
My eyes are just hurting from crying for so long that I cannot even cry again because of the situation I've found myself in.
Unrelenting price rises and a brutal insurgency had already made it hard for people in a northeastern state to feed their families. Then in September, a dam collapsed, flooding the state capital and surrounding farmland. Trost Malombo, the head of program for the Northeast at the World Food Program, describes the situation as a crisis within a crisis within a crisis.
What it means is that beyond the food insecurity that is there, there is conflict and displacement, and with the climate change, we have witnessed a situation where we have immense devastation due to the floods, and this has really pushed people to the brink of their food insecurity.
Torrential rains and floods in 29 of Nigeria's 36 states this year have destroyed more than 3.7 million acres of cropland, affecting over 9 million people, according to the United Nations. But Malombo said, with international donors focused on crisis in Gaza, Ukraine and Sudan, Nigeria is not receiving enough funding to meet its growing need for food aid.
That's Alice Rizzo of Reuters reporting.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. Thanks for listening.